Last time I outlined some features of the past and some features of the present fortunes of literacy. The term literacy, strictly speaking, denotes the use of littera, alphabetic letters. And we extended the term once to cover writing with other characters, like syllabaries and Chinese, and we're extending the term again today, obviously. Every new medium means a new culture, a quest for a new or updated identity, and a war. I reviewed briefly themes from 8 or 10 of Marshall's books and some of his principal tools of investigation, including the 4 laws of media. We also thought a bit about the characteristics of contemporary writing as regards sentence and paragraph length and structure as indicators of mental processes. And I left you with the image of literacy as a hydra, which, with its head cut off, has sprouted numerous new heads, little literacies galore. Today, let's examine the present and future of literacy and some possible responses. First, of course, I take it as given that we are in a period of post-literacy. This is not something that really needs argument. We're surrounded by people, in other words, who know how to read but prefer not to. That's good enough for post-literacy, right there. That will kill it. that is to say, literacy is obsolete. Literacy, capital L, alphabetic literacy, the old literacy. And one of the signs of obsolescence, as I tried to indicate with the hydra, is proliferation. It's a sure sign when something, some aspect of culture or some habit or something suddenly is everywhere in all sorts of different modes. That's a good sign it's obsolete. Obsolescence doesn't mean it disappears, clearly. Obsolescence means there's a new future, a bright, rosy future, but it's not going to be the same as it was. There are a number of signs of obsolescence over the last 50 years. We could have seen this happening ahead of time. One occurred with concrete poetry. And the poets then began playing with words as things and playing around with letters and letter shapes as artistic objects. That indicates right there a big change in sensibility. If suddenly you see familiar things in a new light, it's not because they have changed. Another indicator was something Tom Wolfe brought to our attention in the 60s. He had a book called The New Journalism. And the new journalism would seem pretty old-fashioned now, but it was rather radical then. It meant reportage, reporters giving the reader the experience. Reportage that gave you the feeling, not the facts. The facts were there, but they were sort of incidental. The news was in the feelings. They gave you the experience of the thing. And they also told you in the article how you should feel about these things, which prior to then and still is largely the province of the editorial. Another indicator that literacy was entering a new phase in the 50s and 60s was speed reading, high-speed reading. Something came unglued, and there's a new mode, a whole new way of experiencing literacy. Well, that alone is enough to put things in a new light. Speed reading, not in the order of, say, 500 words a minute, which quite a few people then could manage without too much effort, but 5,000 words a minute or 20,000 words a minute. I mean speeds. Another indicator of that phonetic literacy was on the skids. Occurred a little later in the 60s and 70s with what we call the whole language approach to teaching reading. With that, out the window goes the phoneme. And with the phoneme, along with the phoneme goes the baby with the bathwater. Because the phoneme is a very important part of exactly how the alphabet rearranges and rewires our brains and our senses. Another indicator was the shorter attention spans reflected in changes in paragraph length and sentence length. And these have been going on apace all through the 20th century. And as I indicated last week, right now, in some kinds of writing, they're very brief in the some of the romance literature, the Harlequins and so on. Average sentence length gets down to, well, single digits, eight or nine words a sentence. Now, this, I'm not at this point casting any kind of aspersion. I'm just saying, look what's happening. Keep an eye on it. It's a new way of packaging things for a vastly different kind of imagination. These books are very carefully tailored to produce a very specific range of effects on a very specific readership, and they're quite good at it. They're just as good at it as academic books, which seek to produce a different effect on a different readership with different expectations. Never mind about, let's say, the intellectual side of these things. Keep an eye on the structural side. What's going on in the senses? We've been redefining literacy. Here's another indicator. Since the 70s, the redefinition started back then. We started calling libraries, if you'll recall, in the middle 70s, learning resource centers. That should have told you something right there about the book and literacy and what's going on. And now, of course, we have a whole mess of indicators, including the demise of copyright and the collapse of the reading public. I just picked up in a book called Cultural Literacy this afternoon, written some years ago by Mr. Hirsch, that in the 1830 to 1842 period, just before the onset of the telegraph, there were a total of, in that 12-year period, in the U.S., 1,112 new titles over 12 years. Last year, or not last year, in the year 2002, there were over 160,000 new titles in the U.S. Now, if you've only got, let's say, 100 new titles a year, any reasonable literary person could read them, all of them. Two books a week isn't going to break anyone's neck, as any university student knows you've got to read 5 or 10. So two books a week isn't bad. And one of the characteristics of the reading public was that this was a group of people that read the same books and talked to each other and talked to the author. There was a very lively ground of dialogue and conversation and argument. And when a really new book appeared, it was a sensation. With 160,000 new titles a year, nobody can read it, even a fraction, a meaningful fraction. That is enough to bury and smother any public. And we did it. I also mentioned last week, and read a little bit to you, from Marianne Wolfe's book, Proust and the Squid, which I am very excited about still, as providing a paradigm for comparative literacy study of all kinds. And there are going to be quite a few kinds. Here's one of the things she wrote. She said the brain enjoys a state called open architecture, which is a term familiar to computer scientists. Open architecture means it's almost complete, but it's ready to adapt to whatever situation presents itself or whatever demands are made. Marianne Wolfe wrote, learning to read changes the visual cortex of the brain. It changes it. Because the visual system is capable of object recognition and specialization, the expert reader's visual areas are now populated with cell networks responsible for visual images of letters, letter patterns, and words. These areas function at tremendous speeds in the expert reader, thanks to several very important processing principles. a certain Donald Hebb proposed the notion of cell assemblies, groups of cells that learn to operate as working units, rather like algorithms. If a common letter pattern or word like bear appears to an expert reader, it will trigger its own network rather than individually activating the large number of unrelated individual cells responsible for the lines and curves and shapes and so on. This operating principle is the working example of the biological maxim, cells that fire together stay together, and is the brain's basic tool for creating ever-large circuits that connect cell assemblies into a system of networks distributed across the entire brain. The expert reading brain is a veritable collage of these networks for every type of mental representation across the entire brain, from visual and orthographic pattern representations to phonological ones. And that exactly that same process inheres in our adapting to every single new medium and new technology. And if the adaptations have sufficient character of their own, we discover in time that we have a new culture. Post-literacy, I mentioned, is a state or condition in which you are surrounded by people who know how to read but would rather not. And they're not especially good at it. They might read a book a year, might. I frequently ask my students, and they're not academic, how many books did you read last year that you didn't have to? You might try it yourself. Other signs of post-literacy. I was talking earlier about readers. Other signs of post-literacy, one very obvious thing is the book is furniture, which we call coffee table books. This is a new role for the book. It's not there for its content or ideas or intellectual content, but for its image, both the interior image as well as the image it confers on the user. Reading speeds, by the way, are very far down right now. I've been keeping track of those, and I'd suggest that you start to look yourself. If you want to know what's going on in literacy, look at the mechanics and how people are behaving. When I taught readings, high-speed reading in the 60s, the average person came in the door reading at around 400 words a minute. 400 words a minute is a little more than a page a minute, page and a half, maybe. It depends on the page in the book. And by the end of the first lesson, we'd send them home reading at 500, 550, something like that, comfortably. And that wasn't considered speed reading. The same people right now are reading at around 250 words a minute. The students I'm encountering, an average reading speed among my students is closer to 200 words a minute. If you think that the rate of speech, ordinary speech, at around 3 words a second is somewhere in the order of 150 to 200 words a minute, these people are now voluntarily, unconsciously reading at the rate of speech. And one of the big points about silent reading was it lets you double or triple your reading speed. In other words, between reading aloud and reading silently, you realize you're consulting or confronting actually two forms of literacy, or two literacies. Because the effects of reading aloud, what's available to the imagination, and what's available to the imagination reading silently are immensely different orders of understanding and participation. Another sign of post-literacy right now is decline of used bookstores. Another sign, decline of publishing houses. We all remember the bloodbath a couple of years ago. It's not over. And, of course, the decline of the reading public. In Art and Illusion, about 1961, E.H. Gombrich threw a new term at the critics, the beholder's share. Now, he's studying the role of illusion in art, and, of course, at that point you have to look at the illusion present in the senses and sensibilities of the viewer, the beholder. Gombrich pointed to the beholder's share as a very neglected factor in the study of art. But he did also point out that artists, since the middle of the 19th century anyway, had been consciously using their audience's sensibilities as a key to how to structure the work. The beholder had then to complete it. The painting or piece of sculpture or poem was incomplete as published and was completed by the perceptions of the beholder, the user, the reader. The beholder then has had an active part, or the active participation has been a hallmark of the arts since the 19th century, after the telegraph. Telegraph turned the central nervous system inside out, put it outside, and that's when the arts turned their attention inside to the perceptions and the sensibilities. It's also when reading went silent, and that is, the voice, instead of being an outer voice, went inside. And with it, you found it the soundtrack on a movie. The point about, by the way, one point about reading slowly, that movie, that mental movie that we all rely on and enjoy so much, is only present above a certain rate of speed. And when you get down to the rate of speed of speech, no movie. It's gone. So reading at that speed becomes a somewhat impoverished experience. And I'm not really all that surprised as a consequence that readers are not finding it all that satisfying. It's a vicious circle. Anyway, after the telegraph, the attention turned inwards, and the artist, instead of making things to look at, started to make things that correct sensibility and correct perception. Baudelaire called it mask-making. That famous phrase at the end of the his introduction to Le Cher du Mal. He called his reader hypocrite lecteur, mask-wearing reader. So the poem is a mask you put on, and you use it as a means of reorganizing your sensibilities. You're stuck, and you're mired in glue, and you're ossified, and here, try this on, and you'll be able to see things as they are. The content of the poem was fairly negligible. It could be anything that attracted the reader, just like bait on a hook for a fish. The point isn't the bait, the point is the hook. But all the fish notices is the bait. Okay? And it tends to be the same with us when we're confronting the arts. All we notice is the content, if there is any. And if there isn't any, then we begin to complain. But that should be a tip-off that the real content is the viewer. As Richard Lanham put it this way, he said, the locus of art switched from the physical object that produced the physical response to the responses themselves.